We're delighted to welcome with us this morning three groups of students. First, I would like to welcome Waupun High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And Pepin High School students, would they stand? Thank you all for coming a distance. And we also have Edgewood College students. Would they stand? Along with their instructor, who has been a very faithful volunteer for the court system. We've always appreciated your services, Professor. The students are here with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. Students are invited to attend an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students will come for the oral argument. They have been given the briefs in the case you're about to hear, and we'll meet at lunch time with a justice of this court. It just occurred to me, though, our next case was canceled, voluntarily dismissed. Can the students meet with the justice immediately after this class, after this case? All right, that's what we're going to do. The justice will meet with the students immediately after this case is completed. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you'll meet right after this case is completed. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prossett, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we'll call our first case for today, 03AP. Michael J. Landwehr versus Bernadette M. Landwehr. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Landwehr is Rex Andereg, and he has 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Rex Andereg, and I represent Michael Landwehr, who is the appellant petitioner in this case. And on his behalf and my own, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to review this case. I'd like to begin by addressing an issue that I believe is central to this case. And while waiting for the Court to convene, I was reading the synopsis of the case that was put out for the public, and I noticed that it stated that this court will analyze how to balance a presumption favoring the continuity in a placement schedule against the presumption favoring the maximization of placement. And although I do recognize that there is an issue here of competing statutes, in my mind the idea of competing presumptions somewhat misstates the issue, because we have taken the position, and this is where we agree with the Court of Appeals in Keller to a certain extent, that the maximizing placement standard is not a presumption, but rather a legislative mandate, because it does not instruct the courts to presume that maximum placement is in the best interest of children and then allow a party to rebut that presumption. Instead, it's somewhat forceful language that instructs the courts that it shall maximize the placement with each parent. So the concept of maximizing placement, and I know there's a debate over what that means, but whatever it means, it's something that the courts are required to do, and they're not being asked to presume that maximum placement with both parents is in the best interest unless another party rebuts that. The statutes do not allow the rebuttal of that idea of maximum placement.
No, counsel, just excuse me for interrupting you. As I understand best interest, so you're saying that this presumption is over and above whatever best interest means. Is that? Just tell me where it fits into that. So the court, having been a trial judge for, let's say, 13-plus years, many years ago, it seemed to me that when you look at best interest, that seemingly trumped in a close case or a case where there may be some concerns on the part of the court. Now, here, I'm in this case, that may not be the case. There were some changes. Obviously, there was a change in circumstances. But what you're saying is that the court must say that maximization is the key, and it takes precedent over any best interest to consideration.
My position is that the court is instructed, the trial court has been instructed by the legislature to maximize placement with each parent, and that is a statement by the legislature that maximizing placement with both parents, with each parent, is what is in the best interest of the children.
Mr. Anderegg, doesn't the legislature say a bit more than that? It says maximizes the amount of time the child may spend with each parent, taking into account geographic separation and accommodations for different households. It doesn't just stop with the word parent.
That's true. And I think that those then become the primary considerations. We still have the Section 5 factors, and I imagine there may be some question about what role they play. But the legislature has stated, as you stated, that the maximization is subject to geographical and accommodational type of considerations. And so sort of the initial inquiry needs to be on one of geography. And is this something one has to look at geography to see what maximization means?
But if I could follow up with Justice Wilcox's question, in looking at accommodations for different households, would such accommodations include the best interests of the child?
Could you repeat the question? I'm not sure.
In looking at the accommodations for different households, which is the second portion of that phrase, would one take into account as a trial judge the best interests of the child in looking at the accommodations for different households?
Well, I think one would first look at the accommodations of the different households to see, in this particular case, how far the maximization can go. I mean, I think that one naturally has to take into consideration the best interest of the children. But the legislature, my understanding is that if the court looks at a case, and in using this case as somewhat of a template, if geographical considerations allow for an equal placement schedule and the accommodations of the different households allow for a party to accommodate an equal placement schedule, and if the party is interested or is willing to accommodate an equal placement schedule, then the best interest of the children would be to enact an equal placement schedule under the facts of this case.
Let me ask it a different way. What does accommodations mean?
I think accommodations mean, number one, whether the party in particular has a household that can accommodate the children. In other words, the children have a bedroom. Is there sufficient facilities there? If the children are older, do they each have their own bedroom? Or if they're a different gender, do they each have their own bedroom? So the actual, what the household can accommodate, I think, is one consideration. I think accommodations also means whether the party is willing to accommodate an equal placement schedule, or how much placement are they willing to accommodate, because I certainly don't believe the court should foist upon a party more placement than they're willing to take. I also think accommodations mean the party's availability to care for the children, and how available are they in terms of the children's schedule and so forth. Those, I think, are the primary considerations of accommodations.
Mr. Anderegg, I have a way of, I think, harmonizing all these statutes. Let's see if you agree with it, okay?
Okay.
First, the court has to determine if there's a sufficient change of circumstances, right? Because you don't get to modification otherwise, right? So first you've got to get sufficient change of circumstances. And then, once you say there are sufficient change of circumstances and look at those factors, you then have this presumption of the status quo. And so you see whether the change in circumstances and other factors are such that it's in the best interest of the child to modify the placement.
Correct.
All right? Okay. Now, if you have decided that there's a sufficient change of circumstances, and if you've decided that it's in the best interest of the child to modify the placement, okay, at that moment, the modification must attempt to maximize the amount of time a child spends with each parent. And maximize means, it's hard to think about how you can maximize the husband and at the same time maximize the wife, unless you say it's equal, roughly equal, right?
Right.
Okay. So once you've decided that there's change of circumstances, once you've decided that the factors are such that it might be in the best interest of the child to modify the placement, and once you're going to modify the placement, you attempt to equalize the amount of time a child spends with each parent to the extent feasible. If it's not feasible because of accommodation or geography or any other reason, you do the best you can under the circumstances. You think that works?
I do think that works, and I think that in this particular case, using it as an illustration of that formulation, that the court implicitly, I wish it had expressly stated something in this decision about a substantial change of circumstances, but I believe that it's...
We're not fighting about that here. The assumption is that there has been a change.
That there has been. And so, as you stated, we get over that hurdle. And the court then did make a determination to modify the placement schedule, that a modification was consistent with the best interest of the children. And having done that, having gotten to that point, then the maximization standard would kick in at that point and require the court then to maximize the placement with both parents. And I would agree with you that the only way that you can really do that, if it's feasible, is to have an equal placement schedule. And so I do think there is a way to harmonize these statutes without going the route of the Abbas decision, which effectively nullified one of the statutes.
Well, take this particular case. You've got the parents living close to each other. Is this driving distance or walking distance?
The distance that we refer to in our briefs, I believe, is driving distance.
So it's not 8 minutes to the school by walking or 10 minutes to mother's house by walking. It's driving distance.
Yeah, and I think they were actually a little bit closer than that in terms of minutes. I'd have to refer to my brief, but I think they were only like a mile and a half away or so from the school.
It's still not the walking distance right. For these young children. All right. Seems to me that even if you overcome sufficient change of circumstances by the father going into his own business, factors are such that you can modify placement, because he's no longer on the road and there's a proximity of housing, may not be next door, but closer than Milwaukee to Brookfield. So the status quo is rebutted, but doesn't mean totally rebutted, in the sense that the status quo is still there and still has some vitality, but you can still modify. Now, in this modification, maybe during the school year, even though you might have 1 week at one house and 1 week at the other, the court may very well reach the conclusion that's not in the best interest of the child. Do you agree the best interest of the child always dominates?
I don't agree with that, because
okay.
I think the maximization standard, the problem with the best interest standard is that it really is sort of a carte blanche for the trial court. It grants too much discretion. And my reading of the statutes is that as the years have passed, The legislature has tried to curtail that discretion a little bit to provide a little bit more predictability and equity.
But the legislature has also been very firm in, at least as I read the history here, that it is not limiting the discretion. But ultimately, the discretion is the child's best interest. That's in the trial court. The difference is that they put little weights in there, which the court should consider. But you always have the balancing of the best interests. Maybe you disagree with that reading.
I think I do disagree with that reading, because as I look at the evolution of the statutes over time, I look back to a point in time where all there was as a standard was the best interest of the children, and there were these factors. And under that scenario, a trial court judge could come up with, let's say, a schedule that just provided for one night a month for a parent or one night a week. And as long as the trial court judge justified that schedule with a rationale that was based on those factors, it was pretty much beyond reach of the appellate courts. Would not be an erroneous exercise of discretion. And then we got to the point where the legislature said, I believe, that we don't think that that type of schedule is really in the child's best interest as a public policy matter. We think that the schedule placement should be regular and meaningful. And so they injected those words into the statute. And following that point in time, the previous example that I gave you, where maybe it was just one night a week or one day a week, perhaps would no longer hold up upon appellate review, because who could say that one night per month is regular and meaningful? And to that extent, now the trial court's discretion has been somewhat circumscribed. Now we've taken the next step. I think the legislature has said, actually, as a result of the regular and meaningful language, I think we started to see sort of a sort of a standard schedule that was every other weekend, maybe one night per week, and we had that for a couple of decades, and that would hold up as regular and meaningful upon appellate review. And I think the legislature has said, we've evolved as a society, we recognize the equality and the importance of both parents, and now we want to do something, we want to put in another standard that's going to circumscribe the trial court even more. We want the trial court to maximize the placement with both parents, because we don't approve of this every other weekend, one night a week schedule as being the standard. And so they've curtailed the trial court's discretion in that regard.
So you're saying, just so I understand, you start out with 50-50. I mean, that's what basically, here we have 65-35. And as I understand it, what the court did was to look at the, quote, best interest of the children vis-a-vis the school schedule, and said basically to disrupt the schedule would not be in their interest. So that, but and I don't disagree with what you're saying as far as what we're moving toward, obviously, having a husband and wife have more contact, but still having the best interest. Now here, you know, 129 days, the maximum, you have 365 days a year, so split it up. It seems to me that a court should have some, and when we talk about discretion, because otherwise it would be, you don't need a judge, you would have the 50-50 standard, you get 50%, you get 50%, that's the way it is, and that's in the best interest, and the court could say that. But what I'm driving at is, if the court has discretion, where could the court have used its discretion here when you start out with the 50-50?
Well, when I review the decision of the trial court in this case, I agree with you. I think it reveals that the court relied primarily upon the fact that the children were doing well in school. It also referenced the ages of the children. I think they were about 10 and 6 years old at that time. Never really explained the relevance of that, but one thing it did was rely primarily on the school performance, and ostensibly because it believed that given the school performance, the best interests of the children were served by not giving Mr. Landwehr any more time during the school year. It didn't really maximize the amount of time that he got and he was available to receive. And the fundamental problem, I think, with this approach...
Well, it maximized... No, this, I don't want, this is not taking issue, but it maximized it in any non-school time. In other words, in the summer vacations as I read this.
Yeah.
So the main thrust here was, okay, if we do this, I think that it would be disruptive to their schedule and possibly affect their school performance. Now, if let's say we agree with you, but my but is the court not to take school performance and the best interests of the children in that area into consideration?
Well, we can, and I know we keep coming back to the best interests of the children, and I understand that that's somewhat unavoidable when we're having these types of discussions. I want to keep reminding the court that my belief is that the trial court has stated, or rather the legislature has stated, that maximizing placement with each parent is in the best interest of the children. Now, to address your question, certainly the court is entitled to consider school performance. That's one of the factors. But I think the fundamental problem with the approach the trial court took in this case is that it elevated a single Section 5 factor above a larger legal standard. The legislature has required maximum placement, and the school performance is a single factor for consideration. And so when you've got a single factor, which is essentially trumping a larger standard, you've got a situation really where the tail is wagging the dog. And instead of that factor serving the standard, it's sort of become the standard.
Mr. Anderegg, let me ask you a question in regard to the guardian ad litem. I understand the guardian ad litem here recommended greater visitation or placement, if you will, during the school year. And apparently, again, at the appellate level, has made it clear that that's the recommendation. How much weight do you think the trial court should pay to the guardian ad litem's recommendation in regard to maximizing the placement?
Well, to the extent that, getting back to where I started, where I said we may have some debate over what maximization means. I mean, a trial court has to determine what maximizes placement in a particular situation. And so I think the guardian ad litem determination of what a maximum placement schedule is certainly is entitled to some weight. It certainly ought to express the wishes of the children in that regard. I think it's just to the extent that the trial court has to look at whatever recommendation is made to it, whether it be by the petitioner or the respondent or the guardian ad litem, it ought to look at those recommendations and ask itself, how does this maximize the placement? So,
did the trial court judge meet with either of the children in this case?
I don't believe the trial court judge met with either of the children in this case directly.
Were the children's desires then brought before the judge by the guardian ad litem?
I do believe the children's desires were presented to the judge in a written report to the from the guardian ad litem.
Your position boils down to, once you get past change of circumstances, once you get past the fact that modification is okay, and that the statutory presumption of status quo has been rebutted, that it is mandated that the court give maximum time to each parent. Maximum time meaning equal. It is mandated. And that you don't have to have a special best interest of the child test or standard, because the legislature has said, as a matter of law, equal time is in the best interest of the children. Isn't that your position?
That is basically my position, yeah. Although I do have...
It sounds a little harsh when I say it.
It does, but...
that's really what you mean.
It's good to hear you say it, though. But that is basically what our position is. And although we do have... we have taken... Well, first I want to say that I do think that the way that the statute is set up is that that even if there is some concern for example, in this case, even if there was some concern about school performance, and there really wasn't any basis in the record to believe that the school performance would deteriorate if Dad had it overnight on Wednesday to Thursday morning rather than taking him back at 8 in the evening, or every other week kept him until Monday morning rather than returning him at 8 on Sunday night, that their performance would deteriorate, and that he was also involved in homework. The record establishes that. But even if there was some legitimate concern, that the very structure of the statute strongly suggests that the legislature has determined that maximizing time with both parents is more important than school performance.
Counsel, let me just, if I may interject, because we're tossing around to maximize the time. The Chief asked, is this your position, that what's mandated is to give the maximum time? And you said yes.
Meaning equal.
Meaning perhaps the most or equal time. The most time you can give. Give the maximum. You know, you give someone a maximum sentence. What does that mean to the students here? It means they get as much as they can get. But what does to maximize mean? Does it mean something different to that? Let's say to the students here today, hey, you're here in the Supreme Court. For some of you, this is the only time you're going to be here. So maximize this opportunity. What does that mean? It probably can mean to make the most of. So I'm not sure giving the maximum time means the same as to maximize the amount of time that you have. And yet you seem to be using them interchangeably. Can you respond to why I should read, because you don't want me to, but why shouldn't I read this provision as to maximize the amount of time the child may spend? Let's say I'm a mom, the child is with Dad during the week, I have placement every weekend. Every weekend. But the problem is my job requires me to work every other weekend. So, boy, that's not maximizing the placement, because the kid's sitting in my condo watching TV and I'm off at work. So tell me why my interpretation is wrong, to maximize the time, the amount of time.
Well, first of all, I do think that in the example that you gave with regard to the students that are here today, you are using the word maximize in a way that doesn't deal with something that's quantifiable. Maximize the experience that you get today. I think use of the word maximize in the statute is use in a quantifiable sense, one, because historically courts have been concerned about quantifying the amount of time that a parent has with a child. It leads to other considerations that deal with child support and so forth. The statute always says maximize the amount of time, again suggesting that we're talking about something that is quantifiable. But I don't disagree with you that doesn't mean that necessarily means then we need to have an equal placement in all circumstances, because the statute also says that you got to take into account geography, you also got to take into account accommodations. So if you've got a situation where a parent is getting time just for the sake of getting time and they're not even there because they have a job, then you would do something less than equal placement. The trial court still has the discretion to say, I'm not going to order equal placement if you can't accommodate it because you're not even at home, and maximize under those circumstances, such as the over-the-road trucker example, which is a good illustration. Maximizing in that particular instance might mean one or two nights a week. And I see that.
Mr. Andreg, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. O'Neill, representing Mrs. Landwehr.
please the court, my name is Bruce O'Neill, and I represent the respondent, Bernadette Landwehr. If it was up to my client, she would have me argue the facts today. She would have me state that her daughters are 12 and almost 9 years old, that they have thrived and done well under the physical placement arrangement that has been in place for the last 7 years. They are excellent students and people. Looking into the future, they may stand like me and Attorney Anderegg before this court someday. They may be on this court someday. And if they could speak, I submit that they would say, why does anyone want to alter the path that they've been on for the last 7 years? And in response to the question posed by Justice Crooks, the guardian ad litem did report to the trial court that the children did not want any change in the physical placement arrangement that they had at the time. But I've told my client that the girls have been caught in the winds of justice and that their case, almost at random, is the one where the Supreme Court will decide for all of the state the meaning of a set of laws. The father makes 2 arguments that are frivolous. First, he argues that if the moving party proves a substantial change in circumstances, there must be equal physical placement on a modification motion unless there are problems with geography, household accommodations, or unfit parents. Second, he argues that the statutory presumption of status quo on a modification motion only means there is a presumption that the primary placement should retain some physical placement incident to the motion. These positions have no merit whatsoever. What is the law, then, on modification motion in this case? We start with 2 alternatives. One is that Section 767.24 sub 4 sub D sub 2 applies to both initial placement determinations and modification-type placement determinations. The other alternative is that the statute only applies to initial placement determinations. If the statute does apply on a modification motion, and I submit that at the end of the day, that in trying to harmonize these statutes, that that is what the law says. My client submits that it works like this, and this is the exhibit I put up on the screen, and to use Justice Prosser's terminology, it is our position as to where these standards and presumptions and factors fit in with one another. First, and this was Chief Justice Abraham's starting point in her analysis, first, the father, as the moving party in this case, must prove a substantial change in circumstances since the last placement order. If he cannot do that, he's not entitled to be heard on his motion. If he proves that, he only gets to further argue the motion. The substantial change in circumstances does not mean that there will be a modification. Second, he then must prove that the modification is in the best interest of the child. This has been, is now, and I submit always will be the pole star of physical placement rulings by the courts in the state of Wisconsin. It is the standard. It does not follow, as frivolously argued by the father, that he gets equal placement or any other modification just because he has proved a substantial change in circumstances. We then go to the third factor on the sheet, and that is the father then has the burden to rebut the presumption that the status quo as the physical placement should stay in place regardless of a change in circumstances. There is no competing presumption here. In the Abbas versus Palmersheim case, the Court of Appeals did deal with the competing presumptions of status quo and joint legal custody. And in the statutes, it calls it out as a presumption on joint legal custody. There, the appellate court held that the joint legal custody presumption did not apply on a modification motion. In our case, the maximized placement language in Section 767.24 sub 4 sub D sub 2 is not a presumption. It rather is a requirement as to scheduling if you get down to that fifth step, each of which the father must prove in his modification motion. If he has proved all of those, if he has rebutted the status quo presumption, if he has proved that a modification is consistent with all of the applicable Section 767.24 sub 5 factors, and there are 16 of them, and is in the best interest of the child, then and only then do you get to that fifth point and that is when the schedule is set, it must provide for regular, occurring, meaningful, and maximized placement. I agree with the statement, another way of putting it, as set forth in the appellant's brief on pages 11 and 12, that it is something that is present in every situation as opposed to the 16 factors, some of which are present in a given situation and some of which are not. But going back to the presumption of status quo on a modification motion, it stands alone. There's no other presumption. The requirement of maximized placement does not rise to the level of a presumption, much less a standard.
Counselor, if the court has ordered a change in the summer placement of these children, and in order to do that, didn't the court have to determine the presumption of the status quo was rebutted?
Yes, the summer, yes. And I don't think it follows that just because there's one change...
Counsel, you have to stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry.
We're recording you and we can hear you better.
Sure. It does not follow that just because there's been a substantial change of circumstances that then there is an across-the-board change of anything and everything.
So you're saying that the status quo can be looked at month by month, or here the trial court apparently looked at it summertime versus school time?
Absolutely. I mean, you could have a change in circumstances where somebody in their job gets the month of November off or December off because of a plant closing. That's a big change in circumstances. And sure, there should be a modification of placement time in the month of December for that father. If you've got a working mother, why should the kids be in daycare if they're not in school if the father has the whole month off? So, yes, it's a very fact-driven analysis. And the court applied that here in using its discretion to say that he found a substantial change in circumstances. So we haven't appealed that. We agree there was proven a substantial change of circumstances and that it was a basis for changing the summer placement.
But you dispute that there was a substantial change in circumstances affecting the children's best interest during the school year? Is that your point?
No, there is a substantial change of circumstances. The next question, though, is then you go, do you rebut the presumption of status quo?
Right.
If you've rebutted that, then how do you apply the 16 factors, with the 16th factor being all other factors, so it's almost an unlimited set of factors, then how does that apply to that situation? And one of the factors, as you know, is the children's adjustment to school. And that was one that the court put a lot of weight on.
Thank you.
Well, do you view as, I assume the answer is going to be no, but then you can tell us, the husband here views the modification issue about maximizing to mean equalizing as best the court can. How do you describe maximize? Because I don't see that, as I set forth my theory, that it's very much different than yours. And Mr. Anderegg agreed with that, essentially. It all boils down to now we're at the bottom line of the 16 factors plus the mandate, as he would put it. How do you view maximize? Do you view it as a 17th factor?
In a way, yes. I don't really see it as much other than a factor, except it's a factor that's present in every situation, as opposed to the other 16. But I think once you have gone all the way through these four steps and you've gotten down to the point where there is going to be a change, and, for example, there's going to be more placement with the father, then given that schedule, how do you maximize the placement? For example, here the court felt that during the summertime, the father would have 10 Wednesday overnights that he didn't have before, that this was the change. But it doesn't mean equal. It just, and you could cite the example that was cited before of the truck driver that's only home one day a week. Of course you would focus on that one day and giving him. If you decided on a 9-5 split over a 2-week period of time, you would look for the 5 days that best fit that non-primary placement parent's schedule. It simply means given what you've got, and that is you've arrived at a splitting replacement between the two parents, then within that schedule, how do you maximize the placement for the father? How do you maximize the placement for the mother?
Counsel, aren't you reading out the words of the statute with that interpretation? That is reading out the words, the amount of time. It doesn't say amount is what I'm focusing on. It doesn't say within the placement that you have, you got to maximize the time. It doesn't say maximize the time. It says maximize the amount of time. Your opposing counsel points to that and says we're talking about something that is, you know, quantitative, amount of time, not just qualitative, you know, make sure you make the most of the time, but maximize the number, maximize the amount of time that the child may spend, not maximize the time that the child is spending. Can you respond to that?
I think two initial responses to that. First of all, the legislature could have said there shall be a presumption of equal placement. They didn't say that. Secondly, on a modification motion, they could have repealed the presumption of status quo. They didn't say that. They used this word maximize. They used it in the same sentence of regularly occurring. They use it in the same sentence as meaningful placement. To take that word and elevate it to equal placement, to stand the law that stood in this state for centuries on its head, to say from now on it's going to be 50-50 placement, the legislature wouldn't have been that indirect. It wouldn't have been that oblique where we all have to sit up here and sift the words and study the words and decide what that means. And one thing I ask the court to keep in mind in our appeal, of course, is that we're here on a modification motion. I think the argument that we would be having with the court today might be very different if we were arguing an initial placement determination, because all that the court said, or strike that, all that the legislature says in 767.325 is that if you get down to that fourth step in my exhibit, the court shall consider the factors and make a decision that is consistent with 767.24. That is a word of art, consistent. I think to the non-lawyers in this room, say that the word consistent is a key word here might be Clintonian parsing that they don't appreciate, but I think to every member of this court, you appreciate that is a very precise word and that the legislature meant to make a very different test on modification motions than it did on initial placement determinations.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If you get down to the fourth step, the court then goes in. And, Your Honor, the difference between your analysis in questioning of Attorney Andreg and mine is that I have the maximizing down as a fifth step. You had it as the fourth step. I think you go to the fourth step next, and that is you analyze the 16 factors, including the 17th factor of anything the court considers to be relevant, and arrive at whether or not there should be a change. The trial court here made a rational decision. The trial court here had wide discretion. He listened to 2 days of testimony. He had the guardian ad litem reporting directly to him. He had the guardian ad litem being there as the voice of the children and expressing their wishes. And the decision he arrived at, obviously, Mr. Landlord disagrees with it. Perhaps other members of this court disagree with it. But it's a rational decision. It's not an abuse of discretion for Judge Sasson.
Is that decision written?
I'm sorry, what?
Is that decision written?
No. We've got the transcript.
All right. And what did he say about it?
He set aside a separate day for us to come back and hear his decision. It was a studied decision.
And what did he say about maximizing?
He was not asked by the attorney for the father to, Judge Sosny, please address 767.24, sub 4, sub B, sub 2, and maximize the placement here. That statute was never cited. It never came up. Rather, the argument by the father was, I want 50-50 placement. The Judge Sosny referred to the best interest of the child four times in his decision on the record, and so he did not use the word maximize, nor was he asked to by any of the parties. And indeed, as the Court knows, that argument doesn't come up until page 48 on the Court of Appeals brief. That was not a focal point of this case.
Well, should it have been?
Yeah, I agree that the trial court has a duty to follow the statutes, whether they are called out to them or specified for them. But I do think it's totally unfair to Judge Sosny to say that he should have said, well, here's my decision as I apply 767.24 sub 4 sub B sub 2 when nobody calls it out to him. But he meant it. We were there to talk about whether or not there should be 50-50 placement, which it couldn't be any more maximum than that for the father.
The standard of review is erroneous exercise of discretion.
Yes.
There were no mistakes by the trial court as to the facts, were there?
No, none whatsoever.
So the question then is, was there a rational decision? And you would say yes. And then the other question is it based on the law? And that's really what we're talking about now, where the trial court had no attention called to this maximize provision, right? Didn't consider it, right?
I think he did in his intuitive way, and since we're there to talk about 50-50 placement, it was teed up for him, and he rejected 50-50 placement.
You think he had the power to reject 50-50 placement?
Do
you think he had the power to reject 50-50? Because Mr. Andrick says, no, he didn't, because it was a mandate. Once you got to 5, it's a mandate.
And he doesn't get to 5 with regard to the school year, because he didn't get past the presumption of status quo as to the school year. So you never get to 5.
Well, Mr. O'Neill, if I can follow up the Chief's question. Are you in agreement with Mr. Andrade that if you get to 5, it's a mandate, or are you in disagreement? What's your position on that?
It is a scheduling requirement that once you have gotten to the point where the father goes from, say, a 11-3 or a 10-4 split to a 9-5 split as being what's in the best interest of the children, then within that 9-5 split, how do you allocate the 5 days? And that's you maximize placement within that schedule.
Maximize within that schedule.
Within the 5 days. How do you allocate the 5 days?
But you're not agreeing with Mr. Andrade that mandates a 50-50 split.
No, absolutely not. No,
that's what I'm trying to...
No. No, there's no way the legislature would have been that indirect with that sweeping type of blockbuster decision to let everybody just try and figure it out indirectly.
Counselor, if I understand what you're saying correctly, and if I'm wrong, please straighten me out. It's your position that when the trial court determines that there's going to be a change in placement, it determines approximately what it thinks is in the best interest of the child. And with that first determination, then it determines how to best maximize the time with each parent so they are actually able to spend meaningful time during the days that they are given placement. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you describe or summarize what you think the legislature was trying to accomplish in terms of changing the law in 1999?
Well, we know this, and it's our position the statutes aren't ambiguous, so you don't get the legislative history. I suspect members of the court may disagree with that. We wouldn't be here if there wasn't an ambiguity. There's also case law that says that the court can consider legislative history if it supports the plain meaning of the statutes. But if you get to legislative history, we all know that the charge was led in 1999 in the so-called Gary George bill to mandate equal placement. That was the debate, and that bill did not pass, and they came out with a different piece of legislation. So we know darn well that the legislature did not intend to have a mandate of equal placement. If you consider the legislative history for 10 minutes, that's, I submit, clear as a bell. If they wanted to mandate equal placement, they would have taken Gary George's bill and passed it into law.
Well, but you'd also, I think, agree that the legislative history would indicate an attempt to get recognition that both parents are important in the lives of the children, and that to the extent there was any holdover presumption of the value of motherhood, this presumption has been continually eroded by the legislature so that both parents are viewed as equally significant in the lives of the children.
I agree there's no presumption for motherhood, absolutely.
Right, and you will agree that since, I guess it was 71 or thereabouts, the movement has been towards recognizing the value of the father, on the assumption that the value of the mother has always been recognized.
Certainly, the law used, there was a tender years doctrine that an infant or younger child should always go with the mother, and we're way past that.
Right. But, I mean, that was the goal, wasn't it, of the supporters of this amendment on maximizing, to keep moving towards equalization of the parents in placement?
Well, I think it was simply putting in a factor that the court always has to consider. If you look at the 16 factors, regular, occurring, and meaningful is one of the 16 factors. Maximizing isn't. So they took that factor and elevated it to something that must be considered in every situation, if you get down that far.
When you come down to it, Counselor, doesn't the court have to consider specifically these particular children and their needs, and this particular father and this particular mother, and how their skills balance with the needs of these children?
Absolutely.
So if we just say that it has to be 50-50, you kind of cut the individualized consideration of these children and the skills of the parents out of the pie, don't we?
I agree with that.
What does the language mean, counsel, with regard to 767.325 sub 2? Now, this deals, of course, with modifications of substantially equal placement orders. But under B, it says, however, under sub 1B, which is after a two-year period, there's a rebuttable presumption that having substantially equal periods of physical placement is in the best interest of the child. What does that mean with regards to this case?
It's simply status quo is what they're saying. Nothing more than that. I don't even know why they had to go through that, because you always start with a presumption of status quo. They're just saying in an equal placement, existing equal placement situation, that shall be the status quo. And I think, again, it's important to note in this case, being here on a modification motion, that the father stood before the court in the year 2000 and stipulated to this primary physical placement being with the mother. And we're back here on a modification motion with a presumption of status quo. And he did not rebut the presumption of status quo. If you look at his moving papers, he says, oh, one of the reasons I'm filing this motion is because my daughter Natalia is struggling in school. I think that's the word, you struggling, or maybe failing in school. And that was totally false. And we blew that out of the water during the hearing before Judge Sosny, brought in all of the girls' report cards, and even got Mr. Lambert to admit on the stand and to retract that. And he agreed that she's done very, very well in school, and he has no objection with regard to how she's done in school, and he's pleased with it. I see my time is up.
Before the 1999 amendment, what would have been different about the court's consideration of this modification?
I'm not sure if I followed that, Your Honor.
How would the decision have been different on exactly the same facts in a pre-1999 amendment decision?
Well, I don't think they would have come out the same in this case. I don't think the 99 amendment affected the way Judge Sosny or any other trial court judge ruled on this. We were in there on modification. There's always been a presumption of status quo, and it was a strong, the status quo was strong here. It was so compelling because the girls have done so well, as raised by their mother, that for the school year, the father just never got over that hurdle.
Counselor, with regard to my prior question, that is the language dealing with modification of substantially equal placement orders, and I know we don't have that here, but your response is, well, that just means a presumption of the status quo. Well, isn't that surplusage? I mean, why should the presumption of equal, substantially equal periods of physical placement be set out separately when there is already a presumption of the status quo?
I really agree that it shouldn't be in there. I think it is surplusage. I think it is redundant. And they limit that presumption to the sole situation where there has been either a stipulated or trial court-ordered initial 50-50 placement, and that after the 2 years that there's that presumption. I don't think it had to be said. I don't think it adds anything whatsoever to this court's analysis of the statute 767.24 or 767.325. And again, the court so easily could have said that there shall be equal placement, and they didn't do it. And I think to construe the statutes the way the father is arguing here leads to an absurd result where you can have a situation with a workaholic father who is not there. He's either physically not there because he's down at the plant, or he's mentally not there because he's in his home office working on his computer. That all this workaholic father has to do to get equal placement is come in and move next door to the mother, or move within 10 minutes of the mother and say, look, I've got some empty bedrooms in my house. I get 50-50 placement. And the court can't take into account that he's a workaholic. The court can't take into account that the kids have been phenomenal in school for 7 years, and that's just absurd.
Was this a workaholic issue before the trial court?
It was that Judge Sosden did not cite that as a factor one way or the other. So I'm citing that only as an example of why you can't rely on just geography and household accommodations as being the factors that is going to drive placement of children in the state. Thank you, Your Honors. Natalia and Elise are hard at work in their schools this morning in the 7th and 3rd grades, respectively, at St. John and Vianney School. And I'm sure if they were here, they would thank you for hearing their case.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Anderegg.
Thank you, Justices. I really do have to register an objection to the way that the word workaholic was sort of cavalierly thrown around by counsel. I think the record in this case establishes that Mr. Landwehr is an interested father. He's interested in having time with his children. And whenever he was given the opportunity to have additional time, he did. And that there's nothing in the record to suggest that he has his children sitting around doing nothing while he's working at home. And it raises a public policy issue that I think, to step back and just take a look at this from a more practical standpoint, if initial determinations of placement are the only time that courts are really required to maximize placement, then it kind of raises the stakes at the time that the family and the children are really most vulnerable and their lives are most disrupted. With the idea that Mr. Landwehr stipulated to this schedule and now he's back trying to get it changed. If you look at this case, at the time the parties were divorced, I'm sure Mr. Landwehr would have liked to have had more time with his kids, and the record establishes that he's a loving parent and he values his time with his kids. But the record also establishes, and this is not uncommon in divorces, that his work situation simply didn't permit it at that time. And a person in his situation going through a divorce doesn't really have a lot of options. Time with his children may be more important to him than his career, his salary, but you just can't go out and find an 8-to-3 job Monday through Friday for the sole purposes of maximizing your availability to your kids. I mean, it's not practical. You're going through some economic upheaval at the time of divorce. Resources that were funneled into one house now have to be diluted into two households. Taking a pay cut's not a good idea at that point in time. That further undermines an already unstable situation. And second, for these reasons, the law doesn't really permit you to do that. It could be that your pay cut is unreasonable and that you're shirking and that income is imputed to you, and now you've got a child support order that you can't pay. And so while it might be ideal at a time to find a job with some same amount of income but just greater availability for your kids, with all the disruptions and the impact on your self-esteem and everything, it's not exactly the best time to be going out and looking for another job. And so someone like Mr. Landwehr is a bit trapped. And here he reacted in a socially, I think, responsible manner. He recognized the economic realities of this situation. He took as much time as he could given the situation, and he stipulated to a placement schedule to avoid litigation. And
Mr. Andrick, if I could, I want to focus back in to the argument, much of the argument that's taken place here this morning, and much of that argument focuses on the second sentence in 767.24(4)(a)(2), where you focus on the language of maximizing the amount of time that a child may spend with each parent. When I interpret a statute, I like to look at the whole statute, and I want to go back to the first sentence in that statute, in that subsection, that reads, before you get to the maximizing, in determining the allocation of periods of physical placement, the court shall consider each case on the basis of the factors in sub 5am subject to 5bm, and that sub 5am of the 16 factors that were listed by Mr. O'Neill during his argument. Now, when I read that in conjunction with the following sentence, and the maximizing the amount of time, tell me why it would be incorrect to read that statute together to say that, look, trial court, in exercising your discretion and allocating these periods of physical placement, look at these 16 factors, and when you look at these 16 factors, we want you to take into account that we want the children to spend as much time with each parent as possible. Why am I reading that wrong?
I don't know that you're reading it wrong. I just don't believe that the fact that the reference to the factors precedes in the actual statute, the maximization standard and the regular and meaningful and so forth, that somehow that means the standards serve the factors as opposed to the factors serving the standards. I think the standards are clear, and I know the counsel suggested that this maximization standard is really something more of a factor as opposed to a standard, as though regular and meaningful would be something that would just be a consideration rather than a requirement. I think the court sets forth the standard, and the factors are then used to best achieve that standard.
But the factors precede the standard that you point out. And if the factors come first, and the factors specifically refer you in sub 5am to best interest of the child, it seems that, at least as I'm reading the statute, it says, look, trial court, evaluate whether or not this child, or where this child should be in taking into account the physical placement. Take into account all these factors. Take into account the best interest of the child. But in doing so, do not forget, the legislature is telling trial court, to not forget that we want each parent to spend as much time with the child as possible.
And I don't think that we're in disagreement over this. My position is simply that, yes, here are the factors. These are the factors we want you to look at. Now take these factors and apply them in a way that maximizes the amount of time that the children spend with each parent. So use these factors to achieve that goal. And it's not just a goal. It's not just a wish. It's a mandate. The court shall maximize the amount of time. And I think that's maximizing the amount of time.
Over-maximized. Thank you, Mr. Andrade, and thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for your arguments and briefs today in yet another case involving placement of children. That concludes the hearing in 03AP2555 Landwehr versus Landwehr. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its next case, and the court will meet in conference at 11:15.